Welcome to the Minor Consult, where I speak with leaders shaping our world in diverse ways. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Tanya Mosley, who last year became the first official co-host of the venerated public radio interview show, Fresh Air. Tanya is an award-winning journalist known for her insightful reporting and engaging storytelling, with deep roots in television and radio. She's the former host of the national news program, Here and Now, and she continues to host the podcast, Truth Be Told, which recently launched a new season called She Has a Name. Tanya, welcome to the Minor Consult. It's great to have you here today.
It's so great to be here, Dean. I'm so excited.
So Tanya, you're in the news business, so let's start with your latest news. You recently launched a podcast called She Has a Name, which has an intensely personal connection. Can you tell us about the origins of the podcast and your journey producing it with your nephew?
Yes, as you said, this is a deeply personal story that also is one of many Detroiters and many people in the world. And when I say that, what I mean is that all of us understand grief and loss. And there is a significant number of people in this world who also has experienced loss by way of a missing person. And that is what happened with my family. So in 1987, my sister, Anita Wiley, disappeared from Detroit, really without a trace. And what makes the story a little more complicated is that I never knew about Anita. She was a half-sister on my father's side. And I learned about her when I was an adult as a journalist through her son, who contacted me once he found out about me. And over the last 20 years or so, we have become family in really beautiful ways. And throughout our connection, we've talked quite a bit about his mother and her disappearance. There was a break in the case in 2020. And based on that break in the case, that was the impetus for us to tell the story of my sister's disappearance and what we now know as a murder.
It's such a moving story. And you mentioned that, of course, you've reported in all parts of the country, but you oftentimes return to tell the stories of Detroit. What is it about your hometown that makes for such compelling stories? And do you think that your personal connection to the city helps your stories connect with your audience?
Oh, I love this question so much because I love Detroit because Detroit is me. It is where I was born. It was where I was raised. And what has been beautiful about being a journalist is really when I was 18, I moved away from home to go to college. And I spent a short amount of time at home after college. But I've been away from Detroit longer than I was there. I realized that recently. But because it was my fabric and foundation, I have had the pleasure as a journalist living, I think, maybe 7 or 8 states. And I have lived in communities all throughout the country. And what is reflected for me is what is so common about the human experience. Some of the same things I see all across the country, I experienced in Detroit, and I see that in Detroit. And I see Detroit all over the world and the different places that I lived and reported on. And one of the things that I have always felt very passionately about, even as a young person, when I knew I wanted to be a journalist, was to be able to tell the stories of Detroit and tell them in a complete way, in a more holistic way, because I knew how Detroit was portrayed. I knew how the world saw Detroit as a city on the decline, a city that was bankrupt. And so to be able to come back and tell a tragic story, but also a story about a city during a time period that is very important for us to understand, has been deeply fulfilling.
You just mentioned that your interest in journalism started at an early age. And I understand that as a young person, when you were in Detroit before you went away to college, you often wrote to staffers at the Free Press, in fact, every week.
Yes.
And that included the columnist and best-selling author Mitch Albom. And I'm curious, What did you say to Mitch and to the other reporters, and how did they respond to your inquiries?
I was such a little nerd, right? I mean, writing to Mitch Albom at 13. The beautiful thing, let's just remember that time period. I want us to go back to like the late 80s, early 90s. The internet was not a thing. How we connected with people that we admired was not through social media or following them. It was through following their work, and maybe you would write a letter. And so it was very common during that time, I think, to write like the people that you were fans of. And I just happened to be fans of journalists, and Mitch Albom in particular, because he wrote an amazing Sunday column that was not about sports, but typically used sports as a metaphor for life. And they were beautifully written, and I knew I wanted to be a writer. And so I was drawn to that. And I would write Mitch just to tell him that. I think I would say things like, I love this story on the Pistons and John Sally. And, I just love to be able to write. And he would write back. And what was beautiful about that time period is that the Detroit Free Press, all of the reporters would write back on this beautiful card stock. They'd type it out and then they'd sign it and send it. And I cherish those letters. They're still in my mother's attic.
That's fantastic. You built your career in journalism, rising through the ranks of both television news and public radio in Fort Wayne, Indiana, Seattle, the Bay Area, and many other locations across the country. What did you learn from your experiencing gathering stories from so many different places around the country?
This is, this is also a really great question because I'm so thankful that I had that experience living in communities, big and small, all throughout the country, because it gave me an understanding of our commonalities, our differences, but also how we really are more the same than we're different. And I think about that a lot because, especially now, when it feels like we're so divided socially and politically and regionally, we really do all want the same things. And that's safety and security and connection. And for us to be able to see each other and understand each other. And I think as a journalist, what I'm grappling with in this moment is how to remind ourselves of that, and which is why I actually do think storytelling can be such a powerful mechanism. Because, through, for instance, this podcast I'm telling about this deeply tragic event that happened in my family, what we can understand is that no matter who you are, you understand what it means to grieve, and what you understand what it means to try to find healing and connection with family. And so, above all, that's what I've learned about us working in different places throughout the country. And I hope that what I do can help be just a little contribution to us returning to that in some way.
Your reporting has included award-winning explorations of the Black experience in the United States. And for your John S. Knight Journalism Fellowship here at Stanford in 2016, you developed a toolkit for journalists to help them better report on race, identity, and inequality. What problems did you see then in how journalists were covering these issues, and what were your insights to help them do it better?
I wanted to explore this idea when I was at Stanford because, as a journalist of color in predominantly white newsrooms, I always found it particularly puzzling that journalists of all experiences could cover just about any topic. But when it came to race, it seems like we were so paralyzed. It seemed like, there would be a journalist who could take on, very difficult issues in aviation and kind of understand those problems and turn it around in 8 hours and do a report. But when it came to something around race and racism, it seemed so complicated that for some reason it was always brought and put on me as the person of color to tackle those issues. And so what I realized though, and I think we forget often, is that racism is an issue that impacts all of us, and we all are a race. And so just because I am a person of color doesn't mean that the racial issue is a thing that only I can tackle. A white person can tackle it too, as a person who is of a race and is experiencing these things in our country from a different vantage point, but an important one nonetheless. And so I wanted to work with social scientists at Stanford to come up with an implicit bias toolkit for us to kind of work through what are some of the challenges that inhibit us all from taking on these issues and talking about them and reporting on them.
Have you seen changes, in this coverage over the past decade?
I think that I have. I mean, we're in a very interesting time period because I think that we're still working out the ways in which we can tell the stories that are happening in the moment while also perhaps trying to correct or trying to fill in the blanks of what we left out in the past. And I
Yes.
think that is what we are kind of in this weird space now, where from 2020 till now, my gosh, that was 4 years ago, we have been like full speed ahead, going back in time, telling you about all the things that maybe you didn't know around systemic racism, around challenges with in every field, even in Stanford Medicine. I know that there was an implicit bias curriculum there that was one of the first in the country that you hear stories about things like this that maybe we did not hear about in the past. And so we want to make sure that we're telling those stories. But what we are at a challenge in is that because we didn't do that for so long, our audiences are trying to calibrate to it while also seeing a changing world and a changing country and trying to understand their place in the world. And so what I'm most concerned about, but what I'm also excited about, a challenge that I'm very excited about taking on, is how can we be a place of truth and understanding, offering context, while also leading people into the present and the future in a way where everyone feels included, that everyone feels excited and interested in hearing about these issues because they see that it impacts them as well as their neighbors. And we're not separate, but more of a connected tissue within this country and the world. And I know that sounds completely like a panacea. Like it sounds very like kumbaya, but I do think that it's a challenge that I want to like always be trying to solve in some way.
Well, thank you. I think you're doing very important work, and I know I speak for so many other people in thanking you for the work that you're doing. Now, you transitioned to the role of host through the national radio show Here and Now and the podcast Truth Be Told. And last year, you were named Terry Gross's first official co-host in almost 50 years of Fresh Air. Why do you think Fresh Air has been so successful in its format for so long?
There are two very clear reasons. The first one is Terry Gross herself. She's a master interviewer. She's deeply curious, and she stayed that way through the duration of her career, and she continues to be so. And secondly, she came at a time when we didn't have that type of show, a long-form interview show on the radio where you could sit for a complete hour and hear an intimate conversation between two very smart people. And we've also grown with Terry. As society has changed, as we've grown right along with her. And so those are the two key reasons why Fresh Air has lasted as long as it does and is still as relevant today as it was when it first started. I think that I'm very excited to be a part of this show. It is deeply meaningful for me because it aligns exactly with who I am and what I have aspired to be and do for so long, is to create space for deep and meaningful conversations. And I think the challenge right now is making certain that people see Fresh Air as that place. You know, there's so many choices today, and I don't take that for granted. And so one of the things that I'm deeply thinking about is, how can we maintain and keep the integrity and the beauty that is fresh air for audiences that have been along for the ride all of this time, while also bringing new audiences to the table so that we can keep public radio strong and this service strong and this show.
Well, I think you're doing it brilliantly, and I'm looking forward to the future. You know, in preparing for our conversation today, it's a fun twist to my podcast to interview an expert interviewer. And I'm curious, what's your approach to conversations on Fresh Air to make your guests feel comfortable and draw out their best stories?
You know, I don't take for granted when someone says, I'm going to spend an hour and a half with you, and I don't know what you're going to ask me, and I don't know where this discussion is going, but I trust you enough for you to lead me in the places that you want to take me. And so because I know that, I am a deep researcher. I want to make sure I know the subject that I am interviewing inside and out. I want to feel comfortable enough not to anticipate what they're going to say, but to know, maybe to have my own curiosities lead me based on what they say, because I do know them. I do know as much as I can know about them. And I think that that is what's been the key for Terry as well. She is the same way. She's always been that way, where she's a deep researcher of the people that she sits down with. And when I do that for myself, I'm then more comfortable because I can sit in that seat, in that natural seat of curiosity. And I think when I'm comfortable, it helps my guests be comfortable because they see it as a space where we are convening as two people who are just having a conversation. That's my hope. So every time I go, I sit at the mic, that is my intention. And most often it works, because being authentic and real, but also being deeply understanding as possible with the subject that you're sitting in front of. Those are the things that have worked for me.
And I think people pick that up immediately. And just as you said, it makes people want to talk, want to share their story, and want to have a genuine interaction with you. Now, the news industry has changed a lot over the course of your career. Local news outlets continue to contract, and sort of mainstream media has undergone a lot of changes, and people more and more are getting their news through a lot of sources that don't have the curation and the dedication that you and your colleagues put into every story that you cover and to every interview that you conduct. What are your thoughts on this, and is it important for us to watch and follow on the national, international scene as we continue to see lots of changes in the way people receive their news and the way we exchange information with each other?
You know, at the beginning of the school year, I have two young children, well, youngish. I have a 17-year-old and an 11-year-old. My husband and I had a discussion about news literacy, because we were noticing that my son, who is now 11, has more access to information. He has more time unrestricted in safe spaces on the internet, but he can explore and he learns a lot of things from YouTube and other places like that. And my daughter, who's 17, the same way. And so we started to hear my son tell us things that just didn't seem true sometimes. And that made me realize, wait a minute, you know, it was something I always knew, that our children and are receiving information from lots of different places, and that there are so many places to get information. And in many instances, in so many instances, it's drowning out legitimate news sources to an alarming degree. What we talked about was providing some sort of sense of news literacy, and what would that look like? And I think that is the next step that we all need to think about when we think about younger generations. They don't have any touch points. They've not been taught what are legitimate news sources to get their news. While we have an existing understanding, whether or not we agree with those news sources or not, we do understand what are mainstream news sources, what are local news sources, what are reputable ones online, what are ones that we should be wary of. We have like a somewhat of an understanding as adults, because we have a pre-existing idea based on what we grew up with, but these younger people don't. And so I'm just thinking a lot about news literacy and how I can use my platform in the way of education to be able to help and bring younger people along so that they can know where to look and what to look for. Because there are lots of legitimate news sources that are very small and are independent, but you need to understand because it's so savvy out there. It's a dangerous place, actually.
Exactly. And in your career, you've been in short form format, for example, as a television reporter where you don't have a lot of time to tell the story. And now, of course, with Fresh Air, it's very definitely or probably the quintessential example of the long form format. What have you learned from each? And for young journalists listening to this podcast, people who aspire to have a career in journalism, what would you say to them as to how they develop their skills as an interviewer and as a reporter, particularly given that things are becoming shorter, at least in most formats today, and the opportunity to really go in depth in a subject is becoming harder and harder to get?
This is such a great question because I have found that all of my experiences have led me to Fresh Air and the ability to do a long form interview that is cohesive. It has a direction. Even though I'm following my curiosities, I'm still thinking about the structure of the actual conversation and the listening experience and the main themes that I want to make certain to draw out so that it feels like a complete full-bodied conversation. And part of that came from my local news reporting experience when I only had a minute or 2 minutes to be able to tell you a complete story. That repetition of having to figure out the anatomy of a story or an anatomy of an interview and turn that around very quickly over and over and over again, actually did prepare me to be able to discern really quickly what is a good conversation, what's a good thread of conversation, and where to go. And I think for young people, the advice I have, and many of them are already doing it, is to get as much experience in every medium as possible. Write, record, audio, video, short form, long form, experiment. Those are all the things that will help you be and evolve. Experiment and evolve. Don't be afraid. Don't say, like, this is how it's done, and then this is it. Because the way that our news consumptions and habits and ways and places we want to receive news and how we want to receive it is changing so rapidly that you kind of have to be nimble in this space. There is no such thing as when I went to undergrad, there was only broadcast, print, and advertising.
Right.
So, we've come a long way where all of those things come together to make what is the modern journalist.
Well, Tanya, I'd like to end with two questions that I ask all my guests. First, what do you think are the most important qualities for a leader today?
Say discernment, but empathy
Yes.
and clarity of vision.
That's great. And what gives you hope for the future?
This is cliche to say, but younger generations, Gen
Sure.
Z,
Sure.
they are really the first generation to come into the modern world that we know now. And we've gone through thick history from the start of the pandemic on through where we are today. So much has happened. We are now a changed society, and that generation has gone through that. And that is going to impact the way they look at the world. It already has. And what I notice from them is that they are deeply curious, but I keep bringing that word up again, discerning as well, because they're so native to what is happening now. They can see it in a different way that we can't. And so I'm very hopeful for the future and what that bores out.
Well, Tanya, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a wonderful conversation. And on behalf of all of us who have followed and continue to follow your journalism, your reporting through Fresh Air or various other outlets. Thank you for bringing such knowledge and wisdom and insight in every story that you do and every interview that you conduct.
This has been such a pleasure.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure for me, and I know it's be a pleasure for all of our listeners as well. Thank you for listening to The Minor Consult with me, Stanford School of Medicine Dean Lloyd Minor. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion with Tanya Mosley, award-winning journalist and co-host of the NPR radio show Fresh Air. Please send your questions by email to theminorconsult at theminorconsult.com and check out our website, theminorconsult.com, for updates, episodes, and more. To get the latest episodes of The Minor Consult, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate the podcast 5 stars. Your feedback helps make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to our next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and be kind.